welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As Ukraine's fortunes decline, the Kyiv regime continues its campaign to maintain Western support. Meanwhile, Russia pushes for a peace process and not merely a ceasefire. It is doubtful more talks in Istanbul will achieve anything meaningful. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Matthew Crosston in Washington. He is a professor of national security and director of academic transformation at Bowie State University. In New York, we have Michael Rossi. He's a lecturer of political science at Rutgers University. And in Naples, we cross to Brandon Weikert. He is a former congressional staffer, senior editor at the National Interest, and author of A Disaster of Our Making, How the West Lost Ukraine. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Matthew first. The most recent iteration of the Istanbul talks went by so fast I didn't even notice they had started. And I actually cover the news pretty carefully. But really the focus now is really turning into the nature of the regime in Kyiv. I'm actually calling this program Kyiv's Regime Decay. We had a number of reshuffling of the government recently, shutting down or neutering of anti-corruption organizations, and oh my goodness, protests in against Zelensky and his policies. It's getting very, very focused on what's going on inside of Ukraine. I don't think that's by accident, and we'll talk about that. But even, you know, Donald Trump, we can't avoid mentioning him ever on this program these days. He said much of the aid that Biden gave Ukraine was misused. Well, I could have told you that right after the Maidan coup, and that's when it all started here. So, regime decay, your thoughts?
There's a lot to unpack there in what you just mentioned. First, I'll start off, though, I'll sign off on one optimistic note in terms of what's going on in Istanbul, in the sense that I haven't ever experienced, from a diplomatic negotiations bargaining perspective, especially in a wartime situation, you always come to the table full of anger and resentment and disagreement and discord, and you don't see any reason for being there, and it seems futile and dumb and grandstanding and posturing. It starts that way. It sort of has to start that way. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to be there. So I'd like to think that while it's quite natural what we're seeing in Istanbul around this time, it doesn't necessarily mean it remains that way. Ultimately, both sides, I think, feel like they want to wind this down. They're posturing to see who gets the right vision of the wind down. And that's going to take place at a bargaining table. That won't take place on the battlefield. As far as decay of the regime, we've studied war for a long, long time. And we've sort of, even though it may seem like common sense, we spent a long time quantifying the idea that if you position yourself as the head of a state that has been attacked unfairly, and you do well in that war, or you're perceived to be doing well, your people will love you. But if you start making bravado comments or start showing off some of your own machismo and think you can make statements about possibly winning, and the war starts to turn against you, your people tend to not like you. So that we might be entering that phase of what's happening in and seeing that on the streets of Kyiv right now, even if the West isn't really showing that much in terms of media.
Well, I think I would go a little bit further, Michael, because it seems to me in the recent political maneuverings in Kyiv is that Zelensky and his circle are actually protecting themselves more from the West than they are fighting the Russians, okay? Because this whole anti-corruption thing, that was brought in after the Maidan coup to keep an eye on aid. And these organizations have had so many obstacles thrown in front of them. Now they're just being dissolved, and everybody knows why. My theory of the case is that they're going to get as much aid as they possibly can because he might be couped himself. There might be more unrest. It could be a lot of things. He's taking precautions here, and he's taking precautions against his patrons. Michael.
You know, the two things that we can always expect to find in Ukraine post-1991? The first is Ukraine has the dubious honor of being one of the most corrupt post-Soviet countries. I don't think anybody here on this panel is going to disagree with that. And the other one is that Ukrainians are very aware of this.
Yes.
And they have absolutely no problem protesting when they see BS. I mean, this is very, very clear. The fact that the demonstrations are small, but they're there enough to make the headlines. And well, in that regard.
Yeah, but Michael, I agree with you completely. What I thought was quite interesting in the similar protests we've seen in the post-Soviet space, the signs are in English. Tell me why, Michael. Go ahead.
You know, when signs are in English, at this stage of the game, how to spot a color revolution when you see it? You know, signs in English, I don't think that this is going to be anything like that. But when signs are in English, you know that you have a wider international audience that wants to see your displeasure. There is no doubt about that. What we do see in these demonstrations is that the Zelensky government, which has been trying for, is it now almost a year, more than a year, right? Since the declaration of emergency powers has been given. There has been no elections whatsoever. And in this case, Zelensky knows he has to do two things. He either needs to deliver on his promises, or, as we just said, if he realizes that the game is up, like most corrupt leaders, you need to start siphoning money away for that rainy day moment when you need to quickly run to a helicopter and run towards some, you know, safe haven with as much money as possible.
Apparently has a taste for very nice real estate around the world. But you know,
very much so. Yes. In England, I think he's worked quite well with the royal family.
Well, I think he bought his mother something somewhere in one of the Gulf countries as well, and a very nice high rise, a nice view. Okay,
Brandon. Nice that he thinks of his mom.
Brandon, you've been nodding your head in agreement all through the program, so go right ahead.
Well, the previous guest brought up the possibility of a color revolution, and in my book, which came out a year ago almost now, I was getting reports from colleagues of mine in D.C. that there was real, you know, mumblings and burblings before she left among Victoria Nuland's people that they were going to try to push Zelensky out and replace him with Zeluzhny. And ultimately that didn't happen. And I think Zeluzhny knew he was going to get a bullet if he even tried to push his luck, which is why he sort of just, skittered off into the darkness there. But I keep hearing his name again in the last 2 weeks. People that I know in D.C. and some of these agencies, his name is on their lips again.
Brandon, I know you know your history, so I'm going to throw it out to you like a real history wonk that I am. It's kind of like the German high command in November 1918 decides on the armistice, and then they say, now we're going to dissolve the government and give it to the Social Democrats, okay?
That's right.
And the Social Democrats never recovered from it until after the Second World War. Yeah, so I get this Zeluzhny thing, but I why would he walk into that? And he's a Benderite.
Exactly, yeah.
Go ahead, Michael. Matthew, go ahead, because he's a Benderite. Okay, go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, I would. It's sort of like there are certain awards you don't want to win.
Yeah, good.
In situations like that, thank you for the nomination, but please just keep me nominated. Don't let me win. But I found the other comment as well about the signs in English. I'd also add, there's nothing, because one of the things that always has been protested from the West about this conflict is that this is sort of Ukraine is protecting itself. We're trying to protect and help defend Ukraine. We don't have that much involvement in this. The English signs sort of actually throw that away, because they're saying the people themselves at the grassroots level are saying we're going to write our protest in the language of the people who matter.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, so our own native Ukrainian, it doesn't matter because no one in the government is of any worth listening to this. We're going to talk directly to the people who actually are wielding influence in the conflict.
Yeah. Brandon, go ahead. Yeah.
This is a regime on its final legs. And honestly, you know, I was quite annoyed with Trump a week ago when he reversed course and he's going to throw in these weapons. But I'm looking at the weapons shipment and it's actually not a lot of, I mean, it's more than they had, but it's not as big as what was going on under Biden, partly because we don't have the weapons. I mean,
exactly.
We're below war reserves. Okay, so,
let me go to Michael before we go to the break here. I mean, I looked at that statement as just theater, political theater. I didn't take it very seriously at all. Go ahead, Michael.
No, I mean, Trump, I promised that we wouldn't talk about the E word during the first meeting, you know, E word Epstein here, you know. I mean, it certainly is not going to distract attention away from that. But I mean, Trump has a proclivity to do a lot of things, see what's, you know, sticks to the wall and what doesn't. The sending of, you know, military aid to Ukraine is rhetorical. Yeah. I mean, at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I would tend to think, Brendan, that it's not sticking to the wall. It's what you stepped into, I think,
that's
is
right.
the problem here. Brendan, real quick before we go to the break here, what do you think of Seymour Hersh's reporting that has come? You know, Seymour Hersh makes mistakes, but he's usually over the target. Again, cooing Zelensky. Go ahead.
Oh, I think it's very much on the table. I think that the CIA wanted to do it. Like I said, 2 years ago or a year ago, and when they didn't do it, that's one of the reasons I think Nuland left government is because they didn't follow through on her recommendations.
Well, it's very Michael. Would you want to weigh in on that before we go to the break?
I mean, Ukraine has been effectively under the proxy control of the West, specifically the United States, since 2014. I mean, that's the worst secret that we have here among the four of us.
That's right.
Okay. You guys are remarkably quick in your answers. All right. Okay, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Michael in New York. Let's kind of pick through again some of these recent events, because I think they're very important. Going through the Financial Times, The Spectator, The Economist, Deutsche Welle, all very pro-Zelensky. They did these, you know, peak Zelensky pieces all the time when he went to Congress and all that. Very, very pro-Ukraine. And now they're very critical here. And the issue that they're focusing on is corruption. But that's not a new issue, okay? That is an ongoing one. As it's already been said on this program, Ukraine is synonymous with corruption. Why are they focusing on this now? Is this part of a stratagem? Is it part of the 50-day deadline? Are all these things connected? Or there's absolutely no strategy at all? Go ahead, Michael.
After 2014, and specifically after Zelensky was elected, and we need to remember that when he was elected in a landslide victory against Poroshenko. One of the stipulations that the EU had provided Ukraine as one of the stepping stones towards eventual membership within the European Union is the setting up of this anti-corruption organization. Knowing full well what I had said before about Ukraine having this dubious title of being one of the most corrupt in the former Soviet Union, the fact that Zelensky has not abolished this organization, but has simply taken full control of this organization, is in and of itself an act of corruption. And so there's two things that the EU is rightfully upset about. And one of those rare moments where they and Moscow are conveniently on the same line. They agree for the same reason, but for different reasons, but they agree. And that is the EU has pumped a lot of money into Ukraine. And with the taking over of these anti-corruption organizations, the tracking of the money now becomes even more vague. And the second is that it just is simply bad PR
yep.
for a government and an individual that they have put their name and reputation behind as being representative of true European liberal democratic value.
Yes, and the rule of law, as von der Leyen said in the last news cycle. Brandon, it's going back to these anti-corruption organizations, I've been told by reliable sources that these anti-corruption committees reported to Western embassies more than anyone in the government. I'm actually agreeing with Michael here. This was one of the prerequisites to get cash because they wanted to be able to track it. Now they won't be able to track it anymore. And that is infuriating Zelensky's backers. Again, is this a preamble to something that's going on? Look at the big picture. Let's do it 30,000 feet from the air.
Yep.
Because, you know, Trump may complain about Vladimir Putin, but he obviously does not like Zelensky, okay?
No, and, how could
and, he? And of course, I don't want to dwell on the E word, as none of us want to, but this administration needs some really powerful distractions right now.
And they're getting them. They're getting them in spades. We have the Russia collusion thing in the store in the news again, which of course is all true. That they rigged the system against Trump in 2016. But you know it's coming out now, and Tulsi's fighting for her position. So this is how Tulsi can help to ensure she remains in DNI as you know Congress is trying to remove her power. So there's that. But I think also the key thing here is. My read, and this is why I said I'm no longer that upset with Trump on the issue of Ukraine. I was upset with him the last week, but actually, I think the end game for Trump is he's going to do some pittance, you know, giving a little bit here
yep.
to satisfy the media, to satisfy the bureaucrats.
And Lindsey Graham.
And ultimately, though, the end goal is he's washing his hands of Ukraine. I'm looking at what the Russians are doing. They've got 160,000 guys coming in. They're, you know, massing along Donetsk and Kharkov and Zaporizhia. It looks like they're getting ready for a big offensive. The Ukrainians are not going to be able to survive that, even with the weapons they just received. It's not enough. We don't have enough to give them anyway. We shouldn't be giving them anymore. I think the ultimate thing here is Trump's going to let the pieces fall where they may. And I think Putin knows this as well. Putin's the only adult right now in the room. And I think Putin knows he can read the room. He's going to get what he needs to get for Russia in Ukraine. And then once that's settled, by force, once that's settled, he can go and talk to Trump and they can start doing deals on bigger issues, on the issues that really matter, rare earth minerals, possibly, you know, a new kind of relationship between United States and
Brandon,
Russia.
What would work is having a new European security architecture. That is
agreed.
The winning ticket. And that was proposed.
Two quick things, Peter.
Go ahead, Matthew. Go ahead.
Just two quick things. One, on the corruption thing, I think Ukraine ultimately, and I think our guests are totally right, in terms of how the EU has been set, Ukraine has always been viciously corrupt, but it's been quietly corrupt in terms of Western media coverage. And so there may be, we've always emphasized other post-Soviet states in terms of their levels of corruption. And what's finally broken the dam, so to speak, with the corruption level issue is it's not so quiet anymore. So sort of like the people lending the money are saying, listen, we had an understanding, right? If you're going to rip us off, do it so that no one notices and be silent about it. Now it's not really that silent. You leave us no choice but to actually now intervene and start taking actions and maneuvers. And in terms of the Putin-Trump relationship, there is one other E word, though, that's important to bring in, I think, which is ego. Trump's, to his detriment, Trump never imagines yes. any relationship with anyone other than in the format and the structure that I am the alpha, you are the beta, this is right. how it goes. And he wanted to believe he was able to delude himself into thinking his friendship, quote unquote, with Vladimir Putin was one of alpha, beta, he's the alpha. And I think as long as there was nothing traumatizing to Putin, he didn't care. He found that amusing. It didn't matter to him and didn't make comments on it. But Putin, I think, as Brandon was mentioning, he's getting to the point now where he feels that he's ready to capitalize on certain initiatives and maneuvers. So it's important to put everything in its rightful place. And that includes educating Donald Trump as to what their actual friendship
yeah, well,
is really
they,
based
some,
on.
Someone should educate Donald Trump. Russians have never had a Western friend for 300 years, okay? It's not going to start under Donald Trump, okay?
Well,
and,
I mean...
It doesn't work that way. Michael, you want to weigh in on that? Because it doesn't work that way, okay?
I mean, the relationship that everybody talks about between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, I think, is more fiction than fact.
I agree.
There is always this assumption in the West that Putin and Trump are two peas in the same pod. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to always say, you know, Trump, as we just mentioned, Trump loves it when Putin calls him things like a genius or incredibly qualified. And I can't help but think that Putin is deliberately doing this to stoke that ego.
Of course he is. Of course he is.
Putin does not care at all. He truly does not care at all.
100%.
And, you know, in this regard, you know, say what you want about the Russian president. But yes, I think that he is much more calculating in this entire campaign. He remains quiet whenever situations like this take place. He's not one to gossip unless there is something that is definitive. But I think he absolutely knows how to play people like Donald Trump, because he has done this before with other like-minded leaders obsessed with ego, like the Turkish president Recep Erdogan, who loves being told that he is the, you know, greatest thing to the country since Mustafa Kemal.
Yeah, but it's very difficult to do that with other Western leaders, because almost all of them, to a person, are idiots, okay? So it doesn't really work that way. Brandon, it seems to me it's a... it's a lost game here. Trump is looking for a way out. Is it going to be, they took all the money, they're corrupt, okay? We can't deal with that. The American people will not stand for it. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene stuff here. Because I think this 50-day window has more meaning than I think most people think. Brandon.
Well, I think that, like I said, I think Trump is consigned to ultimately let the pieces fall where they may in Ukraine. I don't think at the end of the day he's really going to do much more for Zelensky. I don't believe that Trump is really invested in fighting to the last Ukrainian. There aren't many Ukrainians left to fight. I really think that Trump's putting on the big show. This is what he does. He's putting on the big show for everybody to be distracted. And at the end of the day, 50 days is going to come along. That could be when Ukraine has to surrender. That could be the point in which, because we know the summer offensive, these 160,000 Russian troops are planning for, now, getting ready to go in and hit hard. So I'm assuming maybe the thought is 50 days from now, it's all over, all but the crying. And that's what you have to do now, is you have to accept the new reality, which Trump is more than willing to do. The real thing here, though, that I'm keeping an eye on is, you know, I was on another network yesterday or 2 days ago with Sir Michael Fallon, the former UK defense secretary, and he kept repeating the importance for Britain to be involved, to lead Europe now that America, and now that I was laughing, but then I realized midway through, they're going to try to invoke Article 5. They're going to put British troops in the firing line, get those guys killed, and then say the Russians killed them. America has to save our rear ends again.
Michael, the last idiot card, the last joker has not been played in this conflict.
That's
I agree 100% with Brandon here. Go ahead, before finish off the program for us, 40 seconds.
Europe absolutely wants to remain in the headlines. They absolutely are committed ideologically to defending Ukraine. This is one of the liabilities that the philosophy of liberalism, IR liberalism, has, is that they are committed to something that they put their reputation on. Trump is a realist. Others realize when things are lost causes, they might want to step back. Europe will be in it for as long as they possibly can.
Yes, and I will be enjoying their humiliation every step of the way.
Old Cold Warriors never want to leave the
stage. This was a conflict that never should have happened in the first place.
Agreed.
On that note, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Washington, New York, and in Naples. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here on RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.